Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery, and that is why the Machinery Digest exists, a no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello and welcome to Idle Chatter. I'm your host, Ray Bohax, the Hot Rod Farmer from the Farm Machinery Digest, coming to you as always from Cat Swamp Road. Yes, that's a real hillbilly name for the most populated state in the nation, New Jersey. So hopefully today is finding things going well for you, as I always have the well wishes for you, my audience, and for those that are not my audience also. Life has enough struggles on a day-to-day basis without any more, right? So I always wish everyone a good and prosperous and productive day. And what I would like to do is to start out this show by saying that I am current now, that this is not being pulled ahead as the other shows were during my harvest season. We got done with harvest, and I have some of my cover crop down, but not all of it. I broadcast my seed, so I was hoping for some rain, and we haven't gotten any rain. It's been very, very dry here, and it's funny, we were so wet. The water table is very high, is very good. We've had 59 inches of rain so far in Warren County, or in our farm, I should say, during 2019, with a normal being about 48 for the entire year. So we're about 11 inches above normal already, but it has not rained for a while and has been warm. So the topsoil moisture is completely evaporated and gone away, and a lot of people's lawns are starting to burn up. Even the weeds around the hedgerows of the field are starting to give up the ghost a little bit. So it's been very, very, very dry. And since I broadcast my seed, I need some heavy dew or hopefully more than heavy dew, but a good soaking rain to get that seed up. So I did the one field because they were anticipating 50% chance of showers and 1/10 to 2/10 of an inch of rain, but I guess we were on the other side of the 50%, and we all know how that feels, right? And did not get anything, and it's been quite warm. It was almost 90 degrees the other day. Today is quite temperate. It's nice. It's about 73 degrees, but the rain will come, like everything else, and the snow will come, and everything will come in God's time. But what I wanted to do is I wanted to give a shout-out again to Dominic Wilbrink from Michigan, who had told me, took the time and the effort to tell me that there was some sort of feedback noise on my podcast. I've mentioned this before, and then I also want to thank Stephanie Phillips, Kyle Friday, and Lucas North, who contacted me in response to my question in a few shows back about whether anybody hears any feedback or any strange noises in my recordings. And sadly, when I play them back here, I cannot hear them. So it's wonderful that Dominic told me about it, and then Stephanie, Kyle, and Lucas also responded to my query of asking if anybody else is hearing it. So, number of things I just want to say. First of all, I want to thank those people for telling me about that, because it is my sincere goal to make this show as best as it can, not only technically, but also in the audio quality. And it's no fun listening to something if it has any feedback noise in it. And I certainly understand that and respect that. And thankfully, all four parties told me that that the noise was only when they turned the volume up very high, and it was not dynamic enough to make them stop listening. But that is not good enough for me. It has to be perfect. So due to their efforts of telling me, I am investing in some new and better equipment. And so that would be akin to going from a plate planter to a vacuum unit, but still ground drive. And I'm not going completely crazy as far as the equipment is concerned, but I am going to move up because of that feedback noise and that sound noise. And part of my computer was part of the recording element, I'll say, or system. And it seems that, and everybody conferred that, when my old computer blew up and gave up the ghost in the end of June, first week in July, and the new one came, the new Dell came, and that was so problematic it didn't want to work and what have you, that's when the feedback noise started. So there's got to be some sort of ghost in this computer, and I got a ton of money into it and a lot of aggravation, and I'm not computer savvy enough, and I don't think anybody would be able to fix it. So I think that God is using that to tell me to move from that plate planter to that vacuum unit, but still keep a ground drive because you're familiar with it, instead of electric drive units. So that's what I'm hoping to do within the next few weeks. And what I worry about here is, because I am a one-man band, other than Susan from Morgood Inc., who puts the beginning and the end on the podcast and makes it computer-wise into something that could be listened to, and that's not even a good right word, computer-wise, but what have you, but does whatever needs to be done to it to make it go out over the internet. I am a one-man band. So I do not have anyone to rely on to say, hey, geez, can you help me with this? I'm really not familiar with this. So when I started the show, which October 25th will be a year that it's live, started the show, that I wanted to try to get the best sound quality I could with a minimal amount of complexity, because when I turn over my shoulder to look to ask someone something, there's no one standing there. So I have no one that is familiar with this or familiar with recording or anything like that. And acquaintances and friends of mine who claim to be computer savvy and internet savvy, whenever I ask them a question, they go, well, I don't know about that. So I tried to get something going here that would not be overly technical, and I could just worry about delivering the content and not have to be mired in trying to figure out a technology that I have no idea of what's going on with it. So that is why I took the simplistic route, and hopefully this new equipment that shall be coming shortly, and I need to get that up and running. So God willing, I'm trying to get that up and running as soon as possible. I did not order it yet, because I needed to get together with Susan, and she is currently on vacation in Italy. I told her to eat a big plate of spaghetti and meatballs for me, or sweet sausage. Let's help the pork farmers. And so she's coming back in a day or two, and we'll get together. I want her to look that over so there's no hidden problems as far as the software that she needs to use with it. But also, another concern of mine is that I feel that the appeal of a podcast is its grassroots sound quality. And this may sound in contrast to what I said, where I want the audio to be the best, but I don't want it to be so good, as it may sound ridiculous, that I don't sound like the Hot Rod Farmer. I feel as if when I do this show, I feel as if I'm talking to each and every one of you personally, even though I don't know what you look like and have never met you. And I always wanted this show, from its conception, that I wanted it to feel like two farmers, you know, talking over the tailgate of a pickup truck, or at the coffee shop, or leaning on the workbench in the farm shop, or you know, hanging out by the tractor and having a cup of coffee. I didn't want it to be too radio-like or too. I didn't want to put the feedback so high that the horse can't reach it. And I felt that that a podcast has a certain ambiance, like a restaurant. And if you destroy that ambiance, you destroy a lot of its appeal. So hopefully I am not going to make this, hopefully this new unit, the new equipment that's coming in, the new microphone, is not going to make it to such a level that it sounds like a professional radio show, if that makes any sense to you. And if it does, I ask you to please forgive me for that. And just know that I am still just a poor dry land farmer from Cat Swamp Road with just better equipment. So, but the other thing that this new equipment will allow me to do, which I am excited about, is something I wanted to do, is to add a new segment to the show. And I'm not going to tell you what it is, all right? Not that you're going to be sitting there with bated breath wondering what it is, but I'm not going to tell you what it is, and I'm hoping to integrate that once we get the new equipment and to bring more value to your listening time without adding any length to the show. I always don't want the show to be much longer than it is because I do not want it to be a burden for you to listen to. And also, now that I'm done with harvest and getting back to business as usual, is that Susan and her husband Victor and I will be working on trying to move the needle forward on the Hot Rod Farmer YouTube TV channel, or whatever you want to call it. I call it TV because I'm old school, but I guess it's more YouTube on the internet. So I am looking forward to hopefully getting that going and to become a educational resource for everyone in the agricultural community, not only in North America, but around the world. So I'm looking forward and excited about that. A couple other quick little things for all you hot rod farmers. My buddy Bob Ida, back in May, he got a Ford GT. That's not a GT Mustang. It's the GT supercar. And really, it's a beautiful, beautiful car, gorgeous car. And I was there for the delivery. I may have even mentioned it on a show back in May. I think he got it May 9th. But anyway, he was invited by Hot Rod Magazine to go to Atco Raceway in southern New Jersey because I guess they were having their fastest streetcar shootout, and obviously it would not be one of the fastest streetcars because those are like 1,500 horsepower engines, 2,000 horsepower engines. But anyway, but he did get invited. He towed it down there. He didn't want to drive it because they're doing construction on the New Jersey Turnpike, and believe it or not, the windshield on that car is $30,000. So he was afraid that a rock was going to hit it. But he rolled it off the trailer, rolled it into the beams at the drag strip, just, you know, did a real soft launch. For anybody who's a drag racer, they'll know what I'm talking about. I mean, didn't spin a tire, didn't do anything. And the car went 10.90 at 138 miles per hour. So that truly is a supercar that Ford has built. I mean, it goes 10, it's a 10-second streetcar, runs almost 140 mile an hour trap speeds, has a 217 mile an hour top speed, and won Le Mans a number of times. So I guess that is the definition of a supercar. So I just said that to the benefit of all you hot rodders out there that could truly appreciate and understand what that is. And if you are not a true hot rodder, then I apologize for bringing that up and wasting a minute of your time with it. You know, and as we get now into deeper into the harvest season, I'm hoping that everyone is safe and their equipment is running well and running efficiently, right? Because efficiency is very important. But, you know, we're getting into a time now, we're starting to get all the yield contests. And I always like that because being an engineer, you cannot not like numbers. I mean, an engineer applies numbers to everything, right? I mean, that's the metric what we use to both qualify and quantify our success in design. So, you know, the yield contests are all coming up, and obviously I would never enter one of those, or I wouldn't even get on the board for that, but especially with sweet corn. But, you know, I compare the yield contest to engine building, and, you know, it's, and I'm not taking anything away from anyone, please, you know that, and I mean that sincerely. I mean, but, you know, and I why say I could compare it to engine building, because you could go out there and you could build a 2,000-horsepower engine, a 3,000-horsepower engine. I mean, you could look at a nitro-burning NHRA top fueler. They probably have around 7,000 to 8,000 horsepower. No one truly knows because they can't dyno them, but they do. They calculate the power mathematically for what they would need to accelerate the car at that rate. So, and, you know, that's great, but a top fuel motor lasts about 10 seconds and it's shot. So, you know, the analogy or the metaphor that I'm making here is that, you know, I love yield contests. I think it's fantastic that people do this, and I think it's fantastic. But my question, or my, is, you know, does the industry, it's good to move the industry forward, but does it truly transfer over to real yield gains on the farm, and not just the 3 or 4 or 5 acres that are dedicated to that yield contest? And it would be akin to, you know, somebody who could build a 2,000 horsepower motor, but you know, his regular motors only make 100 horsepower. So maybe I'm giving you the wrong impression with that. So I mean, I think it's great. I'm repeating it. I think it's fantastic. I would like to be able to see that whatever is learned in those yield contests to be able to be moved into the total entire farm yield, and none of these contests seem to reveal. And I understand, because you're looking at that 3 or 4 or 5 acre plot, and that's all you're measuring. But I haven't heard, or I have not heard or experienced or read anybody say, well, hey, I got X amount of bushel soybeans and I won the yield contest and my entire farm average is Y, and I was able to take some of the elements from that and really bump my yield. It almost seems like that these growers associations, from my perspective, and I may have the wrong perspective, are only chasing the yield contest and to win the yield contest and the accolades and fame and the spoils that come with that, but are they truly being able to transfer that to their farm and see a substantial yield bump from what they've learned, or are they just putting all their time and efforts into winning the yield contest and their on-farm average is no better or maybe even worse than the national average? So, like I say, if anybody knows anything more about that that's listening, please feel free to re-educate me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. And I am repeating, I am not in any way attacking any yield contest winner. It's wonderful. That's great, but my concern is moving the needle forward for all farmers, and that person moving the needle forward for their farm. And I would, you know, love to hear somebody say, well, hey, I got this much, you know, yield on my soybeans or my wheat or whatever it may be, and then I took that and I was able to gain 10 bushels per acre on my complete on-farm average. So then that's, to me, that's really something. Otherwise, you're building a 7,000 horsepower motor that lasts 10 seconds and has no real value to society. So who knows? Maybe I'm looking at it wrong. Please, like I said, please feel free to critique me on that and open my eyes. But like I said, I'd love to see the yield contest. I'd love to see the numbers, and not the time it becomes a horse race or like a drag race, where you know, one guy's beating the other guy by 2 bushels, and it'd be like a drag race, or somebody beating somebody by 0.2 of a second, and you know, we're championing the guy who's 0.2 of a second quicker, but the other guy really is no slower. It's just almost in the margin of error. But what today's show, now that I could get off my high horse and get back to what you're listening to me for, what today's show is going to be about is balancing, and the need for things to be balanced. And what I'm, you know, what I like to, you know, as a machinery guy, as an engine guy, as a farmer, you should truly love and aspire to have everything in balance. And, you know, when you look at a soil test, and I'll, you know, the disclaimer again is that I am certainly about as far from an agronomist as anyone could possibly be, all right? I could struggle enough with driving the tractor, But you know, when you look at a soil test and you look at base saturation, and it's showing you the balance or the percentage of each nutrient in the soil, and those numbers need to add up to 100%. And I think in agronomy, and what we've, you know, what we've learned from the yield contests and the people pushing the yields on their own farm, is that it's not good enough just to look at some nutrient as far as parts per million or whatever metric is used to measure it, that we need to look at it as far as its balance is concerned. And we need to look at it in relationship to all the other nutrients that are in the ground, and make sure that we're not lopsided one way or lopsided the other. And just looking at parts per million or something, or percentages, cannot give you that answer. You have to look at the whole total picture. And you know, that happens with engines also. You could look at a cylinder head, and the cylinder head could have massive port flow on a flow bench, which is a test device, because the area of the port is so large and the valve is so large, but the velocity through that port is very, very slow. So when it's actually put on an engine, it actually becomes a dog, and it's really a pig, and it's got this huge port because you can't get enough velocity through that port to fill the cylinder in the event time that is allowed. So it's, you know, you need to balance port flow in the cylinder head with port velocity, and you need to balance soil fertility with a balance of it, the ratio of those nutrients in relation to the others, to come up with 100%. And the thing, what I'm trying to lead to here is a segue, that when it comes to machinery, the happiest, best running, smoothest, most reliable, most efficient machinery are ones that are in balance. And depending upon the application, the word balance is going to have different meanings. And that is what we are going to discuss and bring to light today. And then we also have a special delivery question, and that is going to be about why manual transmissions are not that common anymore in both cars and trucks. And that's going to be at the end of the show. So let's start to talk about balance. Now, I've done a show a while back. It's called NVH, Noise, Vibration, and Harshness. And that is the area of study or discipline that balance falls onto. But what today's show is going to be, it's going to be a practical application of balance for things on the farm and for machinery. Now, when something is out of balance, that means that it's not in mechanical equilibrium. It's not in mass equilibrium. It's probably a more accurate way for me to say it. And mass being for our purposes to be weight. Now, when something is out of balance, it will talk to you and tell you. And the way it talks to you and tells you is through vibration. And within the engineering community, a vibration is known as a harmonic. And whenever you have a vibration being sent into any piece of equipment, and I don't care whether it's an engine, whether it's a turbocharger, whether it's a combine, whether it's a tire, I don't care what it is, whether it's a washing machine, is that vibration is, or a harmonic, destroys things. Over time, vibration will destroy whatever it is being sent into. And as an aside to that, vibration also consumes power. And a good friend of mine, I may have mentioned him in the past in the show, and sadly he passed away about 15 years ago, was Tom Hines. And he lived out in Bellflower, California. And he was actually an engineer for Raytheon Missile Systems, and had government, I don't know if it was top secret clearance, but he had government clearance because he worked on missile systems. It may have been the Patriot. I don't really know what missile he worked on, but he did. He was doing missile systems for working with the military as far as that's concerned. And then he used to run in a road race, an open road race out in Nevada called the Silver State Classic. And then there was some other spin-off races of that. And he had a Camaro. And I believe his Camaro ran, it was 87 or 89 IROC. I think it ran 235 or 237 miles per hour. It was quite a fast car. And then I think he ran a track down in Texas, and I spoke to him, and I said to him, "How'd you do it down there, Tom?" He says, "Oh," he says, "you know, we only ran like 221. He says, the track was rough, or the road surface was rough. So I said to him, "Oh," I said, "you couldn't control a car above that?" He says, no, the car wouldn't go any faster. So, and I said to him, "You wouldn't go any faster." He says, "Nah, I would only do about 221. He says, "It was that red line." And I said, "Were you bucking a headwind?" He says, "Nah, there was no headwind." So I said to him, "Why wouldn't it go any faster? I mean, if it went 237 and the altitude was about the same and the air density was about the same, or 232, whatever it went," I said, "why was it 9, 10 miles an hour slower?" He says, "Well," he says, "you got to realize, Ray, and, you know, I didn't look at it this light." He says that the road surface was rough. It wasn't that I couldn't control the car, but the tire was moving up and down. There was no vibration, but he says the tire was moving up and down. And it takes energy to move the tire up and down, and and that energy is being consumed by that rough road surface instead of pushing the car forward. So he says that energy, that rough road surface of moving the tire up and down, is acting almost like a wind resistance, like a headwind, and it's so whatever. So the engine is making full power, but it's using a part of it. There's a parasitic loss, for lack of better terms, for pushing the tire up and down as going over the bumps. So I said, "Geez, you know, I never ever looked at it that way, because I'm not looking to a top speed open, what they call land speed racing record, and I always felt that somebody said that the track was rough, or the road was rough, or the salt was rough at the bottom of the salt flats, that they couldn't control the car at any speed higher, but it really was that the movement up and down of the tire is going to consume power. So when we have something inside a piece of equipment that is out of balance and it wants to be pulled out of its arc of rotation, all right, our arc of rotation by this out of balance condition, it's actually consuming power as it's trying to move out of that plane. So if you have an electric motor and it's hooked up, let's say, to a fan on your grain dryer, and the fan is out of balance, so what's going to happen is that electric motor is not going to deliver full RPM to that fan, and it's going to pull more amperage, and it's going to run hotter, and it's not going to move the same volume of air through your grain bin, because part of that potential energy in that electric motor is going to be used it's going to be sucked up or consumed by the movement of that fan up and down or back and forth or wherever it's going, because of its out of balance condition. So not only do vibrations, aka harmonics, destroy things, but they also consume power. So it is very important for you to understand that. And as any farmer would be who has an affinity for machinery, there is a certain joy, just like looking at a crop and seeing a beautiful, healthy crop with a picket fence stand, whatever it may be, and there's a certain joy and a certain pleasure to operating machinery that has no harmonics in it, or NVH, noise, vibration, and harshness, and works very smoothly. There's a joy to a person like me, all right, that when you know that it's just humming and running very smoothly. Now, as when you talk about vibrations, they talk about first, second, third, fourth, fifth order of vibration. And this is only, I mean, you don't need to know this on the farm. It's nice to know. It's nice to know if you're identifying a vibration, but they're called order, O-R-D-E-R. So let's say if you have a first order vibration. So let's say that you go into the field, you go into the field with your pickup truck, you run through some mud, and a big chunk of mud gets into the rim, the backside of the rim on the tire. And now you get out on the highway, you get out of the field, you get out onto the road, onto the two lane, and you start to run 50, 60 miles an hour, and a truck is shaking like anything, right? It's shaking like anything. Well, that's because that mud that got into the rim, the backside of the rim, is throwing the wheel and tire assembly out of balance. Right? It's got a heavy spot. So when we talk about order, it is the amount of vibrations or imbalance per rotation. So that would be a first order vibration, because there's one chunk of mud that is stuck onto the backside of that rim, and that is that one heavy spot. So on every rotation, that one heavy spot wants to go through centrifugal force, wants to pull the wheel, the tire and wheel assembly, off its axle and pull it out and try to make it spin in an ellipse, but it can't because it's bolted on. Right, so it's that force, it's like hitting something with a sledgehammer. So the amount of vibrations that are induced per rotation are called an order. So if there are two vibrations induced, so let's say you had two pieces of mud, you had one over here and then 40 degrees later on the rim, or 60 degrees, whatever, or 6 inches away, whatever you want to say, there was another smaller piece of mud on there, then you would have a second order vibration. And if there was three pieces, you'd have a third order vibration. So the fact is that when you're identifying a balance, is that it's the order of vibration. So if you have to bring this to closure, let's say you have a tire with a flat spot, you go boop, 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 right? You could hear a tire go, you could hear a guy going down the road with a cup tire. You go, it's cupped and running, boop, 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 right? So that would be one order of vibration if it was creating an imbalance. So that is something you may read about. It's good for you to know. And the more severe, the more orders of vibration, or the more orders of imbalance, then what is going to happen is that you're going to have more harmonics induced. Because instead of, and the frequency of the harmonics will change, and that's really not, meant for a podcast. Noise, vibration, harshness, and frequency of vibration and harmonics is a whole science unto itself. But you may have a first order vibration that is not as that creates more of a harmonic in the piece of machinery than a third order of vibration, because they're almost canceling themselves out. But that's neither here nor there. But the important thing for you to understand, as I said a few minutes back, that vibration or harmonics, or repeat it, whatever you want to call it, destroys things. It destroys engines. It destroys turbochargers. It destroys seals. It destroys shafts. So anything that is going to have a harmonic in it is going to have a greatly decreased service life. And the same thing comes true with tires. When you have a tire and wheel assembly that is out of balance, all right, and has a order of vibration, regardless of how many, first, second, or third, usually a tire will have a first order of vibration, all right, but it could have a second order of vibration, is that not only will the tire wear unevenly and wear excessively, but you will have increased heat and increased stopping distance. You will have reduced traction, and if it's on a trailer, I'm going to stop here for a second, because 90% of the world, unless if it's on a semi, do not balance trailer tires. And this really is a pet peeve of mine, because the trailer tire is just as important to be balanced as the tow vehicle's tire, but very few, if any, do it. So the caveat that I will attach to this, if you have, let's say, a grain wagon, and it's you know, it's not, you know, towing it down the road and it's not being towed fast. So let's say that it doesn't go, you don't go over 25 miles per hour with it. You could very easily get away without balancing those tires, because you're not inducing enough of a road speed. Will the imbalance be there? It most certainly will. But the amount of centrifugal force that's trying to pull that tire out of its arc of rotation is not going to be that great, because the road speed is not high. But if you have anything that you're going above 25 miles per hour with, and specifically if you're going to go for some length with it, some distance, then you really need to make sure those tires are balanced. And, you know, one of the things that people, you know, people feel, you know, lots of things in life, just because you don't feel it or you don't see it doesn't mean that it's not of detriment. And, you know, people don't balance a trailer tires. You know, guys have cattle trailers, they have gooseneck trailers, they have RVs, they have toy haulers, whatever you happen to have on the farm, all right, and horse trailers, and then they don't balance those tires. Well, if you don't balance those tires, you're going to have increased wear, you're going to have increased heat. You know, a lot of guys with tow trailers long distance at high speeds are constantly blowing the tires, all right? That's because increased heat. You're going to have increased stopping distance, which is a safety hazard. So you said to me, how am I going to have increased stopping distance, right, because it's out of balance? Well, because that tire is not contacting or putting the same pressure on the road surface evenly. So if it's going up and down, using the inverse of Tom Hines telling me that his Camaro wouldn't reach top speed because the wheel was going up and down. Well, if the wheel is going up and down, then how effective is the brake going to be when the tire is loading and unloading? You have to try to stop the tire against the friction of the road, not the tire going up in the air. And I mean, maybe it's not going all the way up in the air, but it's loading and unloading because of the imbalance. So you will have increased stopping distance. You'll have poorer traction. So now, or you say, well, it's not a drive wheel, right? How am I going to have traction? Well, it's being pulled. Well, let's say the road is wet. Let's say the road is starting to get a little greasy, a little bit icy, whatever. It's summertime. It's 80 degrees, 90 degrees, and the road is wet. If that tire, then again, just like with the stopping distance, if that tire does not have an equal weight on the road and is going up and down, then you're going to have less traction. So you go around, so you try to make an emergency maneuver, and the trailer doesn't want to follow you. You're trying to go around a curve in the rain, the trailer doesn't want to follow you, all right? And then also, even though you don't feel it in the pickup truck towing that trailer feels that harmonic. And as I said at the beginning of the show, you cannot put a harmonic, you cannot put a vibration to something without causing some sort of damage. And, you know, the example that I like to use is a RV, a travel trailer. All right, people spend $50, $60, $70, $80, $100,000, whatever the number is on these travel trailers, right? These fifth wheel, these goosenecks, they got slide outs, beautiful, gorgeous. They're like an apartment building in there. But anyway, the thing is that if you're going down the road, you're going 60, 70 miles an hour, whatever the number may be, and you're inducing a harmonic into that trailer, you are loosening up in a travel trailer. You're loosening up all of the walls. You're loosening up all of the plumbing inside that trailer. You're vibrating that plumbing, you're vibrating that those water lines, you're vibrating the siding that holds it together, you're vibrating that refrigerator, you're vibrating everything, you're constantly vibrating everything in there. And you wonder why you get someplace, you're towing from New Jersey or California, and you turn the sink on and it leaks all over the place. You say, what the heck happened to the pipe here? It did a lousy job. Well, you vibrated a thing for 3,000 miles. Because you didn't balance the tires. And, you know, shame on the RV companies, shame on the trailer companies, shame on all of those companies, because you could go and look at any new trailer, and I have not seen it, so I'm saying any from what I've seen, and they don't come from the factory with the wheels balanced. And the mindset of the owner is, well, if the factory didn't balance it, I don't need to balance it. And I want to, if you get anything from this show today, if you get anything from this show today, is that you need to balance your trailer tires, your any type of tire that is going to, I like to use 25 miles per hour or over for more than a few miles. So if you're hauling, you know, if you're hauling grain in a grain cart, and you're going 30 miles an hour, 35 miles an hour, and you're going 5 miles to town, well, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, it would be nice in theory for you to have those tires balanced, but it's certainly not the end of the world if you didn't, because you're not going fast enough or far enough. But if you, but anything else than that, you need, it's just as important to have those trailer tires balanced on any trailer, and to have them balanced as it is to have the tow vehicle's tires balanced. All right, so if anything, like I said, if you get that from this show today, I'll think I'll qualify it as a success. Alrighty. So now, let's talk about. Let's go back to engines. Now, today most people, well, I shouldn't say that because it's still a vibrant industry, but whenever you have an engine rebuilt, and I don't care what it's for. What you have to have an engine rebuilt, you need to have it balanced. And to have it balanced means that there's a special machine, it's called an engine balancer, crankshaft balancer, that balances the crankshaft. But it's a whole theory of balance. I shouldn't say a theory, it's a procedure. And you have to weigh the pistons, weigh the connecting rods, weigh the bearings, and you need to have all of these weights, and they set up what is called bob weights if it's a V8 engine. If it's inline engine, it doesn't use bob weights. And bob weights are weights that simulate the mass of the connecting rod and the piston and the pin and the rings on it, all right? But what a lot of Mickey Mouse, for lack of better terms, engine shops do is they only weight match the parts. So in other words, they make sure that the parts are all weigh the same. So all the pistons weigh the same, all the connecting rods weigh the same. And the way they do that is they will weigh them on a gram scale, and then the connecting rod and the piston has a pad on it that you would grind a little bit to get the weight so it's all almost the same. But that is not balancing, because just like we talked about base saturation in our soil in the beginning of the show, that's saying, man, I got, you know, so many parts per million of potassium in this soil, or I got so many parts per million of calcium in this soil. All right, so the thing basically is you're not looking at it as a percentage of something else. So when you just weight match, you're saying all those pistons weigh the same, but the engine builder is not identifying the rotational mass of when it is connected to the crankshaft. So you're saying it's all the same. Yeah, it's all the same, but how is that impacting the rotation of that crankshaft and the reciprocation back and forth of the pistons when it's connected to that crankshaft at 3,000 RPM or 4,000 RPM, what have you. So what I want to bring home here is that if you are having an engine rebuilt and it's going to the machine shop, it needs to be balanced. And if the machinist tells you, that hot rod farmer is full of it, it don't need to be balanced, I just make sure they weigh the same and it's good to go, well, run like heck out of that machine shop and find another one. All right, because, or if you want him to do the machine work because you like him, he may do a good valve job or something like that. So the thing basically is that, or he may do a nice hone job, but then you could he could sublet, which is very common. A lot of engine builders will sublet the balancing to another shop that has balancing equipment because they don't want to make the investment in balancing. And the same thing holds true, which is a more common application than engine rebuilding, is turbocharger rebuilding. You need to, you know, they sell these kits over the internet you could buy, and you know, put new bearings and seals in the cartridge of your turbocharger, and the guy brags and he says, well, I rebuilt it myself. Well, you didn't rebuild it. What you did is you put new bearing and seal in the shaft in the cartridge. So the thing basically is that a turbocharger needs to be balanced. A turbocharger needs to be balanced. It spins at extremely high RPM, 150,000 to 200,000 revolutions per minute, all right, when it's all spooled up. And the life of that turbocharger will be dramatically increased. And usually when you have an out of balance condition in a turbocharger, usually the first thing that starts to go away is the seal, because the bearing is going to start to get some play in it. And as the shaft moves up and down and moves all over the place and dances because of the imbalance in the turbocharger, what's going to happen is the first thing that's going to be violated is the seal. And if the seal becomes violated, it's going to start to push some oil. Depending upon where the seal gets violated, if it gets violated on the compressor side, then it's going to push oil through the motor and it's going to burn it. If it gets violated on the turbine side, which is the hot side, the exhaust side, it's going to smoke out the exhaust but not put oil through the motor. All right, and if it puts oil through the system on the compressor side, what it's going to do, it's going to start to put oil, and I'm not saying quarts of oil, it's going to start to put films of oil through the intercooler. If it is so equipped, some applications, they call it a charge air cooler. Same thing, it's to reduce the temperature of the air going into the engine. And it's going to put oil into that intercooler. And that oil in that intercooler is going to coat the tubes and the tanks of that intercooler. And greatly over time, greatly reduce its thermal transfer. In simplistic terms, it's going to make the intercooler less efficient. So you're going to be putting the air through there, but there's going to be no what they call delta T thermal drop, or minimal thermal drop on that air, because the oil is going to act as an insulator. All right, so the first thing that's going to happen is the turbocharger is usually, in most applications, it is going to start to eat the seal and start to pass oil and weep oil past it. The next thing that's going to happen is that the bearing is going to start to go. And if you get enough play in that bearing and that shaft, what will happen is that the fins on either the compressor wheel, which is the side that's feeding the air, or the turbine side, the exhaust side, is going to hit the volute, the case that it's in, and it's going to bust it off. All right. Now, what happens lots of times, even if the turbocharger was not rebuilt, and this is specifically on the inlet side, the compressor side, is that the person in the engine ingests something, the turbocharger ingests something, a small stone, a piece of rock, or what have you, and it actually breaks off one of the fins on one of the blades, is probably a better term than fin, on the compressor wheel, and throws it out of balance. So take home message here again, not to belabor this. If you have a lot of injection shops do turbochargers, and they could do a very good job, but ask them whether they balance them and whether they have balancing equipment or not. And you could, if they don't have balancing equipment, then I would have to, I don't like to paint people and paint businesses with a brush. You could have a guy who does an excellent job with one thing, but not such a good job with the other. But if you are, and people could say that about my podcast, right? Because in the beginning of the show, I said, well, I have Mickey Mouse equipment, all right? And the thing is that I want to now move up to much better equipment. But the fact of the matter is that if you're sound quality is one thing, and I'm not giving myself a pass on this. Sound quality is one thing, but fixing an engine, fixing a turbocharger, piece of machinery, a hydraulic pump, or what have you, is just like it's so important. We've learned in agriculture that placement of the seed in the ground at the uniform depth, seed to soil contact. I use Keaton seed firmers on my planter. We need to get that seed to soil contact. We've realized that we can't pack. We closed the trench for the seed furrow. That we can't. We have to cover that seed, but we have to loosely pack it. We can't compact the soil. Years ago, they used to think you had to compact it and push it real down hard and what have you. So the thing basically is we're learning that. So a good farmer is very concerned with that. And in like fashion, a good turbocharger mechanic that's going to rebuild a turbo knows the importance of it being balanced and will not go into that business without making the investment in a balancing machine or balancing or piece of balancing equipment, that he would feel very uncomfortable sending a turbocharger out that is not balanced. All right, so that is it's a telltale sign of their edict or their ideology, just like a picket fence stand of corn is a telltale sign of of how the farmer, not that he's a lousy farmer, a good farmer, but how much care and effort and concern he put into his planter. All right, so the same thing happens. So it's very important. Now, also, as an aside, going back to, you know, poor Tom Hines, who's gone to be with the Lord, hopefully. But the thing is that just like he said the Camaro, you know, was using horsepower to move the wheel up and down a rough road, well, keep in mind that if you have a finely balanced turbocharger, that is going to spool up quicker and build boost quicker, and you're going to have a much more responsive and a better running engine that that turbo is attached to. Because what's going to happen is, it's instead of the shaft moving up and down and wiggling all over the place and fighting each other, it's going to use all of that energy from that exhaust going past that turbine wheel on that compressor side, and it's going to spin up quicker, and then you're going to have an engine that makes more, maybe not more peak power, but makes more power, what we call area under the curve, and has a greater throttle response and is more responsive and more economical. And you know, you just, you, hey, you're going into the field with the, with, You got this great yield, right? You're 500 bushel corn. You're going in there with the combine. You go, you know, you're hitting the spot where it's 550 bushels. You're loading that motor, right? That turbocharger comes right on a little bit, keeps everything working properly. That feeder house, everything is moving through the feeder house fine because that engine is making the power. So the thing is that that turbocharger will be not only last longer, and but the engine that it's attached to will have more power and be more responsive because it is using all of its potential energy to move air into the engine and not move the shaft up and down. So now, the other thing that I wanted to bring up about balance is that, you know, just like in agriculture, we talk about plant population. Like my sweet corn, I planted 20,400 per acre. It's on 28-inch rows. The plants, in theory, are 11.5 inches apart, in theory, right? So the thing basically is that, you know, the other thing that you have to realize about balance is that there are degrees, meaning levels, of balance. So let's talk about a checkbook, all right? Now, my wife never balances her checkbook. We actually have two checkbooks. But anyway, I tell her, you just use that checkbook, whatever. And then I'll use the other one I had since before we got married. But anyway, so it's not that we had to divide our money. It just worked out that way. But anyway, is that you could have someone, and I won't pick on my dear wife, because I love her, but the thing basically is that you could have someone that if their checkbook is within $100 of the bank statement, they're happy as a lark. You could have someone that if their checkbook was within $5 of their bank statement, they're happy. And you could have a person that if their checkbook is not dead nuts on to the penny, my friend Art, who also passed away, God rest his soul, he was that way, he would spend hours and hours to make sure his checkbook balanced down to the penny, all right? I do not do that, all right? Full disclosure, that is not me. With my machinery, it is, but not with my checkbook. So the thing basically is that the same thing happens with the level of balance. So you could have a level of balance that's in ounces, that grams, and then what threshold are you willing to accept? So when I was talking about weight matching the pistons, usually you measure, I use that because it's an example that's very easy to grasp and understand, is that you could say, I'm going to weight match the pistons, and the pistons could be weight matched to within 5 grams of one another, or they could be 5 ounces of one another, or 1 gram or a half a gram. So not only do you have to be concerned with the person balancing the equipment, but to what level, a la your checkbook. My wife's checkbook could be $500 off of what the bank, well, $500, she'd probably start to go look for it. But $100 off the check, she considers it balanced. She's good to go. She's happy as a lark, right? So then again, you need to quantify what level of balance this shop is doing on the piece of equipment. And you'll keep in mind also that what I'm talking to you about, and if you go to a company like Hines Industries and go to their website, they're out of Michigan, they make balancing equipment, their CV I think it's CV Technologies in Georgia. There's a lot of companies that make balance equipment. But, you know, we're getting into harvest season, and the rotor and the combine needs to be balanced. And they make the equipment to balance the rotor and the combine. So, you know, don't just think, you know, I was talking about tires, and I was talking about engines and crankshafts and pistons. But anything that's going to rotate needs to be balanced. And the thing is that what you have to do is you have to make sure that that part, when it is balanced properly, when it's being serviced, and then also that whoever is balancing it to a level that is more than suitable for its application. So if you have like a PTO shaft that's only spinning 540 RPM, that's going to be a different level of balance, or not even really need to be balanced, all right? Or I guess it would need to a certain extent to have some equilibrium than a drive shaft on a car that's going 180 miles an hour. So keep that in mind. There are different levels of balance. How precise, or another word is fine, F-I-N-E, how fine is that balance being done? All right? Now, keep in mind also that, for instance, like with drive shafts and PTO shafts, is that a harmonic, a vibration, even if the shaft is balanced properly, can be induced because of the angle that it is connecting the driven versus the drive part from. So if you have a PTO shaft hooked up to a tractor and you're driving a mower and you have that shaft at a very steep angle, all right, then things that you're going to have a harmonic or vibration. That is not due to an imbalance. That is due to the angle of the two joints on the shaft. And when there is a great degree of angle, or angularity is the proper word, on the shaft, then what is going to happen is that the shaft is going to spin in an ellipse, and then the ellipse is going to act like a mass indifference, and it's going to shake that whole shaft and shake that whole piece of equipment. So keep in mind that when you're talking about, but a drive shaft needs to be balanced also. So if you look about, a drive shaft will usually have a balance weight on it. A PTO shaft, they usually just try to machine it, but if it's a longer PTO shaft, it may have a balance weight on it. And if it's a higher speed PTO instead of a 540, it may need to be balanced. But most times, what you are having is a vibration that's induced by the angle, and on the drive shaft angle or the PTO angle, and that happens a lot with vehicles, that you have the wrong angle on the drive shaft, and then the vehicle, car, truck, whatever gets a vibration going down the road, and the guy is balancing the tires, balancing the wheels, balancing this, take everything apart, and it's the angle of the drive shaft, and the angle of the drive shaft may have changed simply because of a mount went bad, or somebody took the transmission out, or they took the rear end out and they didn't put a shim back in, what have you. But that could be a show onto itself, and I will contemplate doing that. So to recap, it's very important for anything that's mechanical that is going to rotate or move to have mechanical equilibrium. In layperson's terms, that means to be in balance, that it has a uniform mass around it, and it is not being pulled out of its arc of rotation. All right, if you have continual problems with something, you know, continual problems, it's even you have a water pump that's or a hydraulic pump that's constantly, you know, going bad, or seal failure, you have a fan motor on a grain dryer that's constantly failing, right, the bearing is going bad, there's a very good idea that they a very good possibility that you have an imbalance there. That harmonic, that vibration that you could tactily feel with your hand or with a piece of equipment will and it's vibration is going to destroy things. So there's no two ways about it. It's just the amount of destruction and how soon it happens. So if you have any questions about it, get your trailer tires balanced for longevity, but more importantly for safety. And if you have any questions on it, please feel free to contact me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. And now we're going to finish up with our special delivery segment. And as you all know, if you've been listening to the show, I am very proud and honored to say that Special Delivery is brought to you by Firestone Ag. That's a company that was founded by a farmer, Harvey Firestone, Columbiana, Ohio. Firestone tests, does all their research and testing on the Columbiana at the Columbiana Test Facility, which is Harvey Firestone's family's old farm. You know, Harvey dreamt of putting rubber tires on the farm tractor because he knew what benefits it brought to road vehicles. And that same mindset of pushing the envelope, of looking to make the farmer more efficient, to look to bring value to the farm, still lives on today at Firestone Ag. And it's very apparent with their 23-degree tread bar design, their new Evo tire, their AD2 technology, and the Firestone of replacement tracks. As I always like to say, the soil is the lifeblood of your farm. Trust it only to Firestone. So we have a letter here, and I'll read it to you quickly. It says, "Hi, my name is Jim Pastor, and I listen to your show in Montana. I have a simple question that I am sure you can answer. Why are all the manual transmissions disappearing from both cars and pickup trucks? It seems as if you can only get a stick shift in a sports car these days. Thanks and keep up the good work." Well, thank you so much, Mr. Pastor, for listening to my show from Montana, which is a beautiful, beautiful state. Then you are 100% correct. And the answer to your question is emissions. And that's no more complex than that. What basically happens when you have an automatic transmission, or you have, for instance, like my little Ford Fiesta has, and a lot of cars have today, my buddy's GT that I told you about, the GT supercar, that's not a GT Mustang, GT supercar has a dual clutch transmission. And when you have that type of transmission, dual clutch is a manual transmission that shifts by itself, all right? It has solenoids in it that move the shift forks instead of you with a lever and a clutch. And when you have an automatic transmission, the thing is that you are keeping the throttle angle constant. And whenever you transient the throttle, when you have a true manual transmission, you're stepping on the throttle, and then you're going to shift, and you're releasing the throttle, you're completing the shift and stepping on the throttle again. One of the greatest offenders in emissions, or what creates the most emissions, is when you have transient throttle operation and you're moving that throttle, opening it and then closing it, because the dynamics that happen inside the engine and inside the fueling of the engine are completely skewed as that throttle is sees transient action. And that is why when you have a automatic transmission, you get into your pickup truck, you have an automatic transmission, you drive to town, right, you step on the throttle. I'm not saying you can't accelerate, but you keep the throttle constant, or you're not opening and closing it. You're only opening the throttle one way, and then you go to transmission shifts, the vehicle goes faster, and then you back out of the throttle, maintain the speed. So the thing basically is one of the hardest things to calibrate, and once you add the juggling act of trying to calibrate the engine to meet an emission standard test, is any type of transient throttle action is going to make the calibration extremely, extremely difficult, and it's going to make it harder to meet the emission standards. And that is why the automatic transmission, for the most part, is going away. They will still do it with a stick shift car and spend the money to calibrate it because they feel that market wants it. But also, like the new Corvette that's coming out in 2020, my friend's Ford GT supercar, no manual transmission, dual clutch transmission, because of the calibration and the emission standards. So it's whenever you're moving the throttle, then the dynamics of the cylinder fill, the fueling, and the spark advance curve changes. When the throttle is fixed and the transmission is shifting by itself, you lessen that to a great extent. So hopefully that answered your question in a simplistic term. Again, feel free to contact me at hotrodfarmer at farmmachinerydigest.com. Well, that brings us to the end of our show. I want to thank you so much for listening. I hope that you enjoyed it. If I could help you in any way, don't hesitate to ask me. Once again, I want to thank Dominic Wilbrink, Stephanie Phillips, Kyle Friday, and Lucas North for telling me about the audio problem I have. I ask you to please bear with me. I honor everyone who listens to this show, that you guys are my heroes. And, you know, this is your show. I am just a steward and the caretaker and a deliverer of it. And I want it to be the best it can be, because I care about you, the American farmer and rancher, and my beloved America, and I want you to be successful, because we cannot have a strong, vibrant America without strong and successful and sustainable family farms. You have a blessed day, and I will catch you next week.